Hello, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who, in recent years, has been sending probes deeper and deeper into Spain. Sorry about that. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm a big mannequin on the back of your Gregory Peck scooter for this episode. Which means I'm actually Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City, aren't I? She was the eponymous hero in Mannequin. Would love to say about fetishizing of mannequins today, so do stay tuned. We're in the 70s.
Wasn't expecting this at all.
So, without any further ado, we're breaking the last taboo and going into colour with Spearhead from Space. Now, Richard, I do believe this was your story.
I was led not just backwards in time, or indeed forwards in time, into colour. Should we just have said something exciting because we're in colour? It is totally different, isn't it? What is this universe? This isn't anywhere I've been before.
It's all film, isn't it? I mean, it's all shot on film.
You know why it's all film, don't you, dear fellow podcasters?
I do, but I'll let you say.
No, it's just because, you know, there was a bit of a strike with the rehearsals with Spaces, but they actually could have still gone on to VT, but the BBC weren't going to sacrifice any of their rehearsal time for their two absolutely lead shows, which could never be cut. And do you know what they were? The Black and White Minstrel Show, and yes, it's Lulu. There are lots of French and Saunders crossovers in this, or I should say AbFab crossovers. So yeah, Lulu is the reason that we get so many seven-parters in this season. She's very greedy, Lulu. So she's more champagne for Lulu.
She's the reason for the season, in fact.
Ah, oh, yeah. It's going to be like that, isn't it?
I'm sorry.
We're in colour. No wonder we're all coming up daisies. I do like what you're wearing.
I actually think there's a snide reference to the strike in the actual dialogue, because General Scobie tours Auto Plastics, and he's impressed by the automation. You know, they're replacing everything with machines. He says, "Damn, machines can't go on strike, can they?"
Exactly.
That is a real, and you know, it's Holmes or Terence Dix being smarty pants about it, and good for them. We're in this beautiful, coloured, lovely, lovely thing, which I'm really happy to say, if Mary Whitehouse was with us, had the very first nude scene in Doctor Who.
It's
a complete afterthought. They were actually, everything filmed, including the Brigadier's office and the cottage hospital, all the rest of it, and the grounds, it's all in the one place. It's one of the Earl of the area's old house, and it had been used as an army base in the war. But that little coronet is because he'd been an earl, and so he had a coronet over his little, it was off one of the changing rooms, off one of his drawing rooms. And yes, all of that is there. But you get to see Pertz, you actually get to see a little bit of the back bottom cleft of Uncle Pertwee. No, I should actually say the coccyx shock shot, shouldn't I? and the tattoo.
Yes.
And did you notice, people have talked, you know, he got that. He doesn't remember getting that in the war one night. Mm-hmm. So it was even in a drunken rage. But did you notice the shape of it?
Is it a snake thing?
Curled around. But have another look at the Doctor's wife. It's the Corsair symbol, which really makes me think, well, you know, the Corsair had been in other forms and other shapes. I'm wondering if there'd been a bit of Time Lord branding with a bit of heavy Corsair on Doctor Action in a past life, or indeed in Season 6B.
Well, yeah, because Matt Smith's Doctor does say the Corsair was a naughty woman at one point, or words to that effect.
I'm putting it out there.
I wish you wouldn't, because it's not a whole lot of Pertwee getting it on with really anything.
There's kind of lovely, rompy innocence to this. We talked, well, this is not the 70s, to be honest. This is still 1969. Mm. Written in 69, filmed in 69.
The moon landing occurred during filming.
Yeah.
Because John Pertwee was disgusted that nobody else wanted to watch it, so Carrie John sat down to watch it with him and they bonded over that.
Okay.
Because they were staying in a hotel and everyone else was off having a drink, and Pert's like sitting in the foyer looking at the television saying, "This is important, why isn't anybody else here?"
Unbelievable that the Doctor Who team would not be sitting and watching the thing that really is, you know, ostensibly what most of the show is supposed to be about-ish, except it's not really, is it?
Yeah, well, Terence Dix was probably saying, we did that last year, but with Ice Warriors.
Yeah, exactly, that's the thing. You just touched on something that's probably, you know, we've got colour. You've got lots of exciting and new and beautiful things, but we've actually got Carrie John.
Oh, isn't she spectacular?
This is how you know it's not a kid's show anymore.
Yeah.
We've got a grown-up. You remember us banging on about, please, can we have another Barbara figure, a mature type of woman in it again? I think we've got one.
When the show starts, I think Jackie Hill is 34.
Is that all?
And Carrie's 30. So we have another grown-up for the first time. And she's terrific. She's really, really funny and sarcastic with the Brigadier.
How could she not be in a pre-proto bubble wrap camel hair?
Oh, it's terrible.
What is that?
Oh, awful.
Is it just the earliest sign of airbags because the cars didn't come with them and she was just really concerned for humanity?
She sewed them into a jacket.
It's really just so she could withstand the gormless gaze of Derek Sherman. You did get to see him. As we know, the big producer guy, he is the one standing in the undercroft of the car park.
Yeah, they drive in.
What kind of deal, what actor could not have delivered a line, a non-audible line where he just has to look gormless and open his mouth?
He's really terrible in that role.
And he's really terrible in that role, too. There's something going on there. His name was Gilbert, the actor who was kicked out. It's Gilbert.
Oh, do we know that?
Yes, we do. Yes, so Gilbert got sadly shafted so that he could wear an outfit.
But back to Carrie, though, she really is the best companion since Barbara.
It's not even, it's the closest is, again, Swan Song, The Avengers, but it's also quite Strange Report, character of Annabelle in that, or Jason King, where you have a succession of women in around, Jason King played by
Peter Wingard.
Peter Wingard, whom we own, who was also in Planet of Fire and Prison. No.
he was number two in The Prisoner.
He was number two in The Prisoner. Yeah, his career was sadly curtailed in the 70s and really, really going really well when he was discovered in his very own form of cottage hospital on one of the commons in London, which is very sad. He'd been Alan Bates' partner for ever and ever and ever. So it's very sad. We've actually got a doctor now who's... Is he the least doctorish so far of the doctors?
One of the things about this is how peripheral the Doctor is to the action.
It's great, isn't it?
It is terrific. And, for a while, Pertwee has some elastoplast over his mouth, which is nice. But he's
just... doing his own stunts, too.
But
his own elastoplast,
He's a bit sort of Troughton-ish. There are little moments, the Delphons or the Delphoids, who, or whatever the hell they are, who communicate with their eyebrows.
As I'm doing now, dear listener.
And he does the charming.
It's the only way I can get away with swearing on this show.
But he's quite charming with Liz. He is sort of funny, but no one really knows who he is yet. And his character doesn't really properly settle down until later in the season.
Which is a really good way of doing it. They did it sort of with Pat in Power of the Daleks when he was really playing it in a hyper way and jumping about.
We
weren't sure, in fact, where he was going to be coming from.
But then this is different.
And it's kind of a throwback, throw forward to Capaldi, Am I a Good Man? We're getting that with Pat. With this one, we're actually getting the adventures of Cat Weasel in a wheelchair. Or actually, if Jason King and Tara King had had a lovely daughter, I think it would be the third Doctor.
See, I think that it's really very effective, but pushing him to the periphery, because it does mean that when he finally comes to the unit base, the Brigadier doesn't trust him. And even though we've seen him fall out of the TARDIS, and we, the viewer, know that he was going to be sent to Earth with a new face, we don't really trust him either. It's really harking back to the fact that we didn't trust Hartnell's Doctor. Because of the mystery around him. And yeah, we didn't trust Pat's Doctor, but we did have Polly saying, oh no, he is the Doctor, to build up the... There's nothing really to build up the trust here. It's very unnerving.
You've just got it. This is why this is such a risk, not just for the viewer in the sitting room, but for the BBC. Because apart from the Brig, and thumbs up if you remember him, because it's only two stories and it's a while ago. If you don't remember the character of the Brigadier or the word unit... There is nothing in this to tell you it's Doctor Who, other than the words and maybe a bit the theme-ish.
Oh, and the TARDIS,
which is, and then it's gone. It turns up again as a box in the corner, but that's it. Yeah.
And you don't see the interior,
which is the iconic
bit, if you like, because police boxes were still not uncommon at this point. So the really unique thing about the show was the big white gleaming control room.
That's a good point. And nor was John Pertwee not uncommon. But we forget what a huge star, what a big thing radio comedy was. Mm. You mentioned before that people, Round the Horn was getting over 20 million listeners on a Sunday afternoon. The Navy Lark, which had been going since the late 50s, was still going and would be recorded through the Pertwee era. was massive, massive hit, and he played Chief Petty Officer, get this for casting, Pertwee. Yeah, everyone used the same names in that. It also had Leslie Phillips, and I'd still play it on BBC 4 Extra. I keep plugging it every week, and it's lovely. It's dated. But it's naturally, I still listen to it, and it's lovely.
It just makes me think how miserable life in the, how post-war it still was.
It sort of was, and it's sort of charming, but it's it gets a bit risque and sort of Leslie Phillips. It gets quite blue by the 70s, and it's much more like I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again, which, of course, are the Brendan's mentioned before, the Goodies and the Pythons before the Goodies became the Goodies and the Pythons. Pertwee is a big, big hit. Was it Carrie who said I wanted to do it because Pertwee, I'd been a fan of Pertwee as a little girl, and he just gave her a shuddering look on set. What do you mean, my dear? But the thing that's so interesting about this is we get a monster that's really surprising. We get the when they talk about the Yeti in the loo in Tooting Beck, and are you all aware that the monster was actually, until reasonably late in the day, going to be the Yeti?
Oh.
Yet a bloody again. Yep, that's why you got the Yetis on his photo call, his second photo call. Yeah.
See, I wondered why, because he invents the Yeti in the loo on Tooting Beck, or at least popularises that as a phrase. You just sort of think, well, you never had any Yeti.
Well, we don't know what happened, do we, in Tooting Beck? Because what with the casting call or why they were called off.
What could have ended in tears. Beck stays in Tooting Beck.
Tears, tears of fuzzy fur felt. But yeah, we've got mannequins, and I think it's the most exciting and creepy thing. And I looked into this because it's the bit everyone remembers.
Yeah.
But funnily enough, when you read the papers at the time, and I admitted to being nerdy enough to go back and read stuff in the papers, people thought it was an episode of The Avengers. They've actually got English reviews. And I love that episode of The Avengers last week when the dummies burst out of it. It just ended, dear. We were still getting Tara King Epps in the 1970s, weren't we?
Is it the first instance of a monster which is a commonplace everyday item turned into a monster? I think it might be.
Mm. Apart from phone.
Apart from phone. and I suppose the whole radio thing with the Cybermen, but... You know, the radios.
That was a nice touch, wasn't it? That the little. You're right. And the 70s will do it beautifully. What do you all think about the premise? There is now, no spinning TARDIS as such. We landed on Earth with a different face. We're actually doing Adam Adamant or Mini James Bond or actually Department S shows that ITC had been famous for, which kind of already passed glory. Strange Reports is the one I mentioned. But
I mean, is it trying to be Avengers-ish as well, like the lovely car? And
I think it's trying to be War Machines.
Oh, yeah. I'll have things to say, I think, when we reach the end of the season. Yeah. We've been through 25 episodes of this premise.
Actually looking forward to that, to listen to this.
but it does seem like they've cancelled my show and replaced it.
I really get what you meant last time when you said this is the end of Doctor Who, and I thought, well, no, it's just the beginning. But it really isn't Doctor Who at all.
No.
And we're getting into interesting worlds. I'm not just talking about the coccyx shock shot, which I have to say again because I really have to practice saying that. but we've got Bob Holmes on Illicit Love, and he's quite a quirky bloke, and he does like playing with people's heads. He was very naughty in rehearsals. He was the one spinning the proto-Colin Bacon cheeky jokes and playing it up, especially with the ladies. And Terrence Dicks loved that, which is one of the reasons they had him around so much. He was fun. But the whole concept of the lifelike mannequin had actually caused a kind of stir. Can we say for a song, have a drink? With a woman called Mary Brosnan, and her company was called Carriage Trade, and it was a US company in the 1950s. Before that, they'd been quite stylized, and they looked actually not unlike current-day Neil Gaiman Cybermen. The store dummies were quite deco and stylized and streamlined. But then we started getting actual really lifelike ones. There was a really big American fashion designer called Lester Garber in the 50s. He was ostensibly queer, but he actually, and there is a name for this, autoerotica, he fell in love with a dummy called her Cynthia. She became his constant companion, and he took her to every first night and every dinner party. Liza Minnelli's own mother, Judy Garland, actually commented on, oh, Lester's brought his tie again. It's a note in one of the books of one of the diaries. Yeah, he was notorious for it, but this became fetishizing of mannequins became a big thing.
It must start with Pygmalion, though. surely.
That's a nice thought. Yeah,
who creates the statue and it comes to life. Mm. You know, that's a very old myth.
But the whole thing of fashion with, when the Zandra Rhodes ones, Adele Rootstein, what a name, was Mary Brosnan's equal in the UK. And produced ever more lifelike thing. And there was actually a thing between these two women to produce ever more. The Zandra Rhodes dummies, if you remember Zandra Rhodes' look with her shock of pink hair in the 70s and her very, it's actually pre-Boy George, the look, but in the 70s, beautiful fabrics, very gauzy, and really pronounced nipples. And then they were sent over to the US, they were sawn off before they could be, before they'd be allowed to be shown in the US. And they started to get very anatomically correct to the point that they were having to then change other sections of these things. So there was a sort of, this kind of thing of the dummies must have been, I'm hoping, at least in Bob Holmes' head when he wrote this story, just because there is something about the face of them and being so close. And, of course, he touches on it also with Two Swords, the uncanny valley, light to be comfortable.
Well, I think that's it. And I think that, I mean, I've heard stories of children being unnerved and frightened by mannequins.
Well, that's us, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Watching the show when we were little. This was on, for the English listener, this was on constantly pretty much in the late 70s and early 80s, wasn't it? I'm looking at you.
Yeah,
in Australia,
not Brenton.
Yes.
Not Brenton.
They used to show from Spearhead from Space all the way through to whatever.
But we didn't get the other three stories from season 7,
or any of season 8 because the Master was in it.
Like, that's right, we never saw Delgado in repeats. Yeah.
So they would just repeat sort of bits and pieces. My actual first encounter with this story, though, was in Terence Dicks' novel Doctor Who and the Auton Invasion, which I still think is actually superior to the transmitted story. It's really, really...
It was one of the first, or was it the first new Target novel to come out? I think it was. And because before that, they'd republished the...
The three.
Exactly.
The Crusaders.
The three originals. Yeah.
Web Planet.
Yes, the Zabi. An exciting adventure with the Zabi, exciting adventure with the Daleks, an exciting adventure with rapey Saracens.
That's right. So this was quite an early one. And like I was a kid, we've talked about this, I used to get maybe 7 Doctor Who novelizations and lay by them at David Jones.
I used to get them from the local news agency. They were there each Saturday, yeah.
And, you know, they were like $2 each or something. I would save up my pocket money and then take them all home. And I read and reread The Auton Invasion. And then my friend at primary school told me that Auton Invasion was actually on television. And I was shocked to hear that it was called Spearhead from Space.
Which makes no sense at all.
I still think it makes no sense.
the original working title, Facsimile.
I like
is
that.
So much better.
Yeah.
But I think that's possibly better for an adult audience. There might have been a lot of children who didn't immediately know what facsimile was. That being said, I didn't know what a spearhead was.
Well, they were going much
word as well.
They were going much more adulty in the original. The original, there were so many drafts, from what we know, but you know, much more adulty and more violent. They toned down the violence for the transmitted thing. They were really being influenced by, you know, the film industry had suddenly jumped to gritty realism. And weirdly, it was a very English thing, but it actually, from what I can see, it actually started with Steve McQueen's Bullet in 1968. Have you seen that?
No.
It's in itself influenced by advertising at the time, which became moments of people just sitting, staring out into the blue and smoking grittily with a girl sitting there, almost no dialogue, and just the flowers moving or the cars moving at great speed and jump cutting and such like. This is kind of like our Boyzone version of that style. It's almost like a Mike Hodges film. You know, Get Carter with Michael Caine, that kind of, or an episode of The Sweeney. And we're getting to even more of that as we go on in this season, and action by Havoc starts to jump in. Sadly, we don't have them just yet. But what are they going for here? The tone is all over the shop. But in this first one, it still feels that like that lovely Indian summer we've talked about, the end of the 60s, where childhood drama and all these other new kinds of making film for TV and are together. So we've got silly romps in wheelchairs that are more like a Margaret Rutherford Ealing film from the 50s when he's racing along. And then we have, I think, my favourite villain of the early 70s, shot through vertical broadline glass so that his eyes look like a fly's. It's Channing.
Oh,
it's Hugh Burton as Channing. Amazing. Channing. I think he's actually the Delgado of season 7. He's just superb.
He was so terrifying in the novel and in those illustrations that I was actually finally a bit disappointed when I saw him in real life.
Were you?
Yeah, but...
I actually find him, his immobility, the way he just stands in the phone box... doesn't do anything, doesn't need to lift a receiver.
I think that is terrific, and the shot that you mentioned where he is shot through the glass and he looks like he has multiple eyes and things, I think that is, it is terrifically good.
What really gets me about his character is Robert Holmes sort of takes a trick out of David Whittaker's book in that he puts off the confrontation between the Doctor and Channing. Aside from Channing trying to kidnap the Doctor, they don't meet until that last 5 minutes.
Well, in fact, the Doctor's so sidelined, because we're setting up the premise of the show, the new premise in episodes 1 and 2. He's so sidelined that the episode 2 cliffhanger is Ransom in peril, and then the episode 3 cliffhanger is Scobie in peril. Like, the Doctor isn't interacting with the plot enough to be in peril enough to motivate a cliffhanger. He really is, you know, on the sideline completely. And so it really is only in episode 4 that he gets in any way involved in the plot. And I guess, you know, that's a little bit like the Christmas Invasion, but I don't think it's quite as conscious or as clever as what happens in the Christmas Invasion, which is the Christmas Invasion shows you how the characters can't cope with the aliens in the absence of the Doctor. That's not quite what we get here.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He is just sort of sidelined because... we kind of want to see him swing into action once he's bedded into place and we know what his relationship is with Liz and what his relationship is with the Brigadier and why he's staying and, you know, what's going on in this sort of new premise.
See, what I really love about that scene is it gives us the best idea of Pertwee's character in the story, which is when he comes in and confronts Channing, he's just very conversational, like they're talking about a piece of modern art at a party when they're talking about the Nestine... let's not say what body part it looks like, pulsating in the cabinet.
No, I think when we get up to that, because I'm sorry, it is the first sphincter in space. And we get, no, really, it isn't. Even as a boy, I thought, is this Kenny Everett doing the special effects as Captain Kremen? It's very Thargoid, isn't it?
What's amazing is not until the Blu-ray do you realise there's green gunge in there as well. You can't see that on the DVD,
that's,
though.
That's the new machine. Yes. Did you know about the new green gunge machine? We'll see a lot more of it.
Yes, we do indeed.
In the novelization again, there's a great, superb picture of this sort of terrifying octopus advancing on Pertwee and Liz.
Yeah.
And it just seeing that it was a sort of sad box with some cling film in it and someone throwing tentacles out of it was a huge, hideous disappointment to me. And Pertwee, you know, is still acting in season 7, but he will retire from acting fairly soon. He has a few tics, you know, that he increasingly relies on, like rubbing the back of his neck or rubbing the side of his mouth or the famous Pertwee death pose with one knee in the air.
Because he's being poised. Less is more.
And here we get his first real proper gurning. You know, he'll gurn again.
Yes, he'll gurn
again when he's attacked by the Silurians in Doctor Who and the Silurians. But here... he really sells the being attacked by tentacles by rolling his mouth about and crossing his eyes and things. It really is a virtuoso performance.
The thing about Pertwee's performance is that he's the one that's really out of sorts in this. He's famously, he said, you know, when he asked Bryant and Sherman when they appointed him how to play it, he said, well, we want Pertwee. So who the hell is that?
Yeah.
And you can see he was apparently quite nervous that... even of Nick, because Nick had been in the show before and knew what he was doing, and Carrie, because she'd just been working with Olivier, that was enough to daunt him. But he's a very multi-layered man, as we know from... I've got his book here, Moon Boots and Dinner Suits. Put a picture up there. And it doesn't really come across because he's such a raconteur, but he was terribly nervous, and we'll go on later in the season, about himself as a performer. He was very reliable to be able to do pretty much any accent... Kenneth Williams School of any accent, as long as it's John Pertwee. You can always tell it's him. And do any role, I mean, it can be, you know, as camp and as silly and fun as you like. But, yeah, he had no handle on this. And I think that's actually why he's so likeable in this story. You really do get the feeling that he's finding his feet.
He does become much less likeable in later series. And he
even later through this season, later he starts to get a little bit too... London Club, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, there's that, but there's also just the fact that he antagonises people in a way that actually makes it more difficult for him. And in particular, the way that he antagonises Dr. Lawrence in the next story.
Yeah. But Boffins were famous for doing that.
And he sort of does it. Oh, he does it to Stallman.
Oh, yeah, he does.
You know, like, he's just obnoxious. And he starts to do it to Ralph Cornish, and the Brigadier pulls him up, and then he kind of backs off and actually ends up having quite a nice relationship with him. But it's not a take on the Doctor that I like very much. I don't think he's that much fun to watch.
Well, I think you and I are going to disagree a lot during this. because I do see the qualities you're talking about, but I think that they are more complicated than just the Doctor being obnoxious.
Yeah, I mean, he's always been obnoxious. Just remember Lala saying, oh, don't mind him, he just likes to irritate people. You know, like, he has always been irritating, but there's a particular kind of irritating...
There's a very Oxbridge... I just saw the imitation game last night with Benedict Cumberbatch, we own him, as Alan Turing, and that very much Oxbridge professor thing, really indifferent and caustic and callous and dismissive, is all throughout the film. And when you think about other portrayals we've seen of films shot in the 60s and earlier of those sort of... It's, I'm not necessarily making excuses, I'm just trying to see where Pertwee's character was coming from. I'd like to think it's not who he is himself.
But he's patrician and patronising. And
it does make him difficult to like on occasion, doesn't it?
I think the really likeable character is the Brigadier in this, and I think he's really terrific. And it's something about Courtney's performance, and you don't quite get it in the 60s ones, although he's heading towards there in the invasion. But he always does it with a slight curl of the lip. But he's amused by what's going on and not really fazed.
He's quite sardonic in this one, isn't he? And almost flirtatious with Carrie. There's little moments. No, of, yes, my dear.
He tries to be, but she just completely.
She's so funny. Yes.
Like, I was even such. Yes, it's quite amusing, don't you think? No, that's no, right. You don't.
That's what we were hearing. The bubble wrap going in the spare room. I thought, hang on, it's not Ark in space. What's all that bubble wrap? The new scheme for this, the reason we're on Earth, is actually just budget cutting. BBC agreed to it because with colour they just couldn't afford all the extra stuff of a new space set every week.
Is what's happening that they've been somewhat surprised to get an extra season. They're in colour.
They're seeing this as the last season. They fully expected that this is it. Kind of like the 2005 season, which is maybe why everyone's putting concerted bid in to really make it work.
Like
the 2005 season is so strong to watch again now.
Yeah, because they don't know they're a sure thing.
Yeah.
Just this week I watched a documentary on Stan Lee, the comics creator. And he was talking about his early work in the industry and how it became so hamstrung because with McCarthyism and chasing comic books and saying they corrupted juveniles and what have you. Pretty much he had to lay off his whole comics department. He was the only one working on them. And he said to his wife, I'm going to get out. And his wife said, don't be stupid. You love doing this. But if you're going to get out, do one comic the way you want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, okay, if they fire you, who cares? You're going to get out. And that comic was the Fantastic Four. That's how the Fantastic Four came about. And that's how this Doctor Who is coming about, because they think they're going to be cancelled anyway. Let's just go for broke, make it this gritty, adult, scary show.
We'll see a lot of that in the next story, won't we?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the one after that.
Yeah, and much like the Fantastic Four, it paid off.
Yeah, I mean, they do have to substantially retool it when they come back in the following year, spoiler alert. It isn't the direction the show will take from now on. It is a kind of a blind alley. The received wisdom for a long time was that the Pertwee era was okay, but Season 7 was great. But having recently watched Season 7 in context, the whole time I was disappointed about the show that they threw under the bus, this doesn't have all of the things that I loved about Doctor Who in it, and I think that's a great shame.
See, I adore Season 7, and I do think that what was happening in the 60s was starting to become a bit stale. I think it did need a massive shake-up. Not exactly tiresome, just stale.
Yeah.
It didn't make me tired. it just made me go, oh, it's this again. Oh, that's nice.
But you've got to feel that way by the end of season 7, don't you? It's like, oh.
Oddly not, but I think I'll discuss that more when we get to Inferno.
Yeah, let's do that at the end.
We have a moment for the logicians. We are assuming that everybody knows this story, but I mean, really, if you're listening to the podcast, you've got to know this story because it's just been around. It's had more iterations on more kinds of medium than anything else we've seen, not just the book. The audio read novelization. We had it on video. It's the only one we've now got on Blu-ray officially and properly. The one bit that really annoys me, can I just have a little nerdism in my head here, is why do they put the real people in Madame Tussauds? Why? It's just so stupid, so they can easily be discovered if something happens to the Auton facsimile. Why put them on display?
Apparently there is a deleted scene, scripted but there not filmed. They explain that much like Zygons, they need to keep the original pattern alive.
So you put him up on big display. What's in the script, and it was filmed. We'd got it on the Blu-ray, but it just this doesn't exist, is that the Scobie Fox facsimile is having to risk detection. So the original is kept alive to mask the signal, but it has to be nearby. And for some reason, it was easiest to have it. It has to be very close to the... Look, it doesn't make sense when I say it out loud now, does it? Which is probably why they cut it. But, yeah.
It is Doctor Who. I mean, it doesn't really matter.
And it's just to have that shot. It is actually Madame Tussauds.
I thought,
it just looks like a really weak BBC curtain on a rep rehearsal stage. Nah, it is. And they're filming it at 1 in the morning, and all those extras are really patient, aren't they? Standing around.
I will say, though, that when you're writing science fiction and you come up with a great idea or a great image, such as replacing a bunch of people with dummies and putting the real people in the place of the dummies, it can be so hard to dislodge in your brain that when you think to yourself, oh, I don't actually have a reason for that, oh, who cares, it's cool.
And Doctor Who is very much like that. I mean, the set pieces and visual things and all of that sort of thing. Mm. It's a little bit like, you know, the way that James Bond films have, you know, giant action set pieces and then paper-thin reasons for them to actually exist, and then
certainly
off to the
at
next
this time.
It's pretty much, that's the reason behind every script that Eric Saywood ever wrote.
Well, and you want set pieces. It's a TV show. You know, you want something memorable. You want something to act out in the playground the next day. And this one is absolutely full of it. I mean, you talk about the
Sorry. That was my Auton gun.
You talk, Richard, about how many iterations of this there have been, but every single relaunch of the show it was cancelled has borrowed massively heavily from this. So the TV movie lifts Paul McGann taking the costume out of the lockers at the hospital.
True. Going to
all of that stuff
in the
hospital. You know, Rose has the Autons and
there was nothing else they could have used.
In Rose as well, they're actually able to afford the scene that everyone imagined had happened but didn't really, which was the Autons breaking the way through the shop windows.
Yes.
In fact, all that you get is, you know, cutting away from the shop windows to the BBC sound effect record of glass breaking, and then they're walking through because they can't afford to break any windows.
It still works.
And it's, it works terrifically well and was clearly in the minds of just generations of
fans.
You
think that's why BBC Wales did it, just so they could show glass breaking? We can afford this.
But do you remember, in fact, if you read the script book, the script of Rose was published along with the scripts of all of Series 1. And Russell wants the Autons to be terribly elegant and well-dressed because they're wearing great clothes, so he wants them to move very elegantly.
And slowly.
I remember too, that when we were first getting kind of spoilers and stuff to Series 1, there was a hint that one of the crucial Auton battles would happen out the front of a bridal shop. And I remember thinking, oh, please, please let there be Autons in bridal gowns. And of course there were. But then the subsequent relaunch under Moffat too in the 11th hour again borrows hugely heavily. We have the Doctor in a hospital going through the lockers, getting his costume together. Yeah. You know, this is something that that has been the template for starting the new show. And
the romp too, thanks for mentioning that, because the big chase that you get in 11th hour is very much the chase. Okay, they get a fire engine rather than a wheelchair. But it's very much the same feeling, isn't it?
So it's like a regeneration story or a launching your show again story, and that's very much what's happening here. And in fact, the one big relaunch of the show that borrows heavily from this is, of course, the following year's Terror of the Autons, which is just as much a relaunch of Doctor Who as this is. So this is a very, very important story, I think, for the history of the program.
You should just mention how well it did. The US bought the rest of season 7, 8, 9 as a job lot. And, of course, in Australia, Hong Kong and Dubai, etc., you know, bought all the 14 stories. The Americans weren't offered Spearhead from Space. They didn't get it. So if we have, you know, if anyone's listening who grew up in the US, you've got every right to go, huh? But it's, why would they not have done that? Surely if it's just filmed, like the Avengers and all the other ITC shows, they were deliberately done on film so they could be easily transferred to NTSC. Rather than doing it on PAL and then transferring it.
I believe that America and Canada were the only other countries who got Pertwee in colour initially. Australia still got 16mm black and white film recorders.
Oh, we still got monochrome, okay.
Yeah.
And we had an odd way of showing it back then too. It was really delayed and choppy. Yeah.
The 16mm film things are, in some cases, the only thing that survives, isn't that right? There are no missing episodes from the Pertwee era. But there were plenty, including in this season, that needed to be recolorized because the only existing copies of them were the 16mm prints. And so that was one of the reasons why these things weren't shown. The whole episodes of the Silurians don't exist in their
original form. And Ambassadors of Death technically only exists episode one is colour. Everything else was monochrome.
So. Yeah. Next season even. And as late as Pertwee's last season, of course, episode one is Invasion of the Dinosaurs. So they only existed in black and white. So we are sort of seeing a reconstructed version.
Yeah, aren't we?
It's a recon.
I don't really want to leave this story. It's just so cool. Haven't seen it, this is the one to watch.
I mean, this constantly is on lists when you go on Facebook or forums or Twitter and someone says, I'm introducing a friend to classic Doctor Who, what should I watch? 90% of people say show them Spearhead from Space. Yeah. Other mad people say show them Caves of Androzani, which is a silly idea.
Well, it's a great episode of Blake 7.
But no, Spearhead from Space should be... If you're listening and you want to introduce a friend to classic Doctor Who, show them Spearhead and then get them to listen to this podcast. So, moving on to Doctor Who and the Silurians with that wonderful score from Kerry Blyton, Kazoo.
It's so weird.
We're still with Kenny Everett and Captain Crewman, aren't we? It's great. Yeah.
So, you did make a mistake just now. It is Doctor Who and the Silurians.
And the.
I just said that, didn't
I? Oh, good, okay. I thought you said the Silurians.
No, no, no. Okay.
So I think we should just talk about the title as if it's a French symposium.
It was called the Silurians, and they used to call the things what? Doctor Who and the Maya.
Or cave monsters in one of the
drafts. No, that's what the novel.
No, the novel. But
no,
it's actually...
just called the monsters. Oh, yeah, it was frequently called the monsters in the.
The format for Doctor Who scripts at that point was to call them Doctor Who and. So Malcolm Hook's previous co-writing with Terence Dix was Doctor Who and the War Games.
Yeah.
This was director Tim Coombs' first job on Doctor Who. And he didn't realise you were meant to cut off the prefix.
So that's why it's...
That's why it's like that. And, of course, this was Barry Lett's first full story as producer. He had a lot going on because, you know, he didn't want to make seven-parters. Ambassadors of Death was in terrible trouble. Inferno still needed extra elements added to its seven episodes. So it just slipped between the cracks. You know, the titles were ordered and, of course, titles were laid on as they were recording. So by the time anyone saw it, it was like, okay, do we really want to spend £100 to do this edit to make new titles? And it's like, eh. Let it go, let it go. nothing more sinister than that. But yeah, it's a wonderful title. Doctor Who and the Silurians.
Yeah, really. So is this mine or yours?
This is mine.
My one. I am going to talk all over you.
Yes, I know.
Can we talk about the other aspect of the title? Which what, is the word Silurians?
Yes, of course, because the dinosaurs themselves hadn't even evolved in the Silurian era. I believe is correct.
It's 443 million years ago.
Oh, what's that between
the Silurian era?
whereas
there were only plants and arthropods on land, and there were no reptiles or apes or dinosaurs of any kind. I mean, it is hundreds of millions of years, and the production team, I think, were aware of this. but they just thought it's a cool name.
Kind of like being a child in the early 1970s with the shops only open till 12 p.m. on a Saturday. That was it. It was actually very Silurian era.
Yes, yeah. It didn't feel like the Silurian era. So, they, you know, it is a pretty cool name, I suppose.
And nerdy children like us, yeah.
They get it right, they try and
correct it. Eocene's too hard to say. That's
and it's wrong anyway, it doesn't work either. There in the Eocene. So it's a giant mistake as well.
Yeah, you see, I think the original mistake is a bit more forgivable because the person who calls them Silurians is a nuclear physicist who is an amateur potholer and archaeologist. So clearly he's just an idiot.
Well, oh, it's, like, just not, it's just not his thing.
Yeah, I'm a Latin teacher and I can crack an encyclopedia, for God's sake. You know, I mean, it's not that hard.
You think, now, is this a Barry Letts story, speaking of people who should have known better?
Yes.
So
this was Barry's first story as producer, but he didn't commission it, I don't think. I think it was commissioned by Derek Sherwin.
Was he working on it? Because Sherwin was working on Special Project Air, wasn't he, with Dr. Martin King. From the, you know, the long forgotten, was it John Rollison? Yeah,
John
from the
Rollison,
Avengers.
Yeah.
Who was Harold Chorley in Web of Fear, which who we've all had the fortune to see now as the irritating reporter. Because you can see, you wonder why that didn't get off the ground, can't you? But no, it would have been a fantastic, called of RAF, fabulous show about really lavish overseas production to rival The Persuaders on the other network with Tony Curtis and Roger Moore, you know, being all terribly raff and fabulous and everyone had a moustache. We'll get to that later in the season.
Yeah. So this is the first 7-part story since The Evil of the Daleks.
Gosh, it is too, isn't it?
And so it's also the third longest story since then. We had The Invasion, which was longer, but that had the Cybermen, and we had The War Games, which was longer, out of necessity. So we have the first example of these 7-episode stories, which was a decision made by Derek Sherwin, which Barry Letts hated but had to live with.
Is it a budgetary decision?
It is a budgetary decision.
It's cheaper to do longer stories because you can use the sets for longer.
Exactly.
Episode one is always very expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's not forget, though, for a second, just how much outside broadcast filming was actually allocated for Spearhead. All those shots and awards. I mean, there wasn't really. I just think maybe, it was used as a bit of an excuse. I think they wanted a big bang at the beginning of the season and they. Yeah.
They used up all their money.
And it's, oh, look what happened, all that naughty strike. I think they were really glad for the strike. It allowed them to actually get all of this across.
It hugely breaks free from the studio look of the 60s, and so it's even more than colour.
That's a really good point.
It makes it look amazingly different.
Because I just wanted to ask you before you bring up your next point, Brendan, did anyone here feel a little bit, lachrymose or bored with the 7-parters? Because I didn't.
The weird thing is, no.
No.
They've got this amazing quality whereby instead of having one overarching plot, they have several overlapping plots. So for each of the 7-parters this season, I've written down what the overlapping plots are.
Because Sherwin actually writes in that interview I was quoting the other week, they were deliberately trying to make every single episode within each story, let alone each story subsequent, utterly different from the one you watched the week before. So you might get a repetition of the plot of episode 3 again in episode 5, but it'll be in a different location. They were really trying to spin it as play of the week, looking as different as they can within the module of it being the same story.
Yeah, so in this story, it starts off as being about a mysterious power drain. And
was having those terrible power strikes at the time.
And you get all these theories that, it's saboteurs from the other side, that mysterious under the bed.
Yeah, Molly Sugden was suffering from it exactly the same time. Now you're being served. Yeah.
Now, the power drain is then explained, but not solved, because it's monsters behind it. And that's the second plot, this plot about the monsters. And
commies.
Yes, indeed.
Unionist commies.
They're insidious.
I don't think so.
The monsters
Nathan's
plot.
Blasting.
They're tiresome. 7 minutes is tiresome. What are you going on about?
Still talking.
That's right.
So the monsters plot is almost solved because the leader of the monster says, yes, we will work in peace with mankind, but then they unleash a virus. But then the virus doesn't work, so they go for a full-blown invasion. And so what happens is, each of these plots is partially resolved, or at least explained, it opens up the next plot. And I think that's why this story isn't tiresome, because it's not just about one thing. It's the same as the War Games wasn't just about one plot happening. Things overlap.
I think they do in real life and in real war.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think that the Silurians of the Seven Parters in this season is the most successful one, and you have identified precisely why.
Mm.
That it does move along. It goes from place to place. Yep. And I think neither of the two that we're going to discuss next episode do that quite so successfully.
No, I disagree. Carry on.
But it's all right. You've been wrong before. So,
it's just like the production team in real life, isn't it?
We all know the colourful monsters is green, Nathan.
But it wouldn't be Doctor Who if things ran smoothly, would it?
And it often leads to really great things happening. Recently, perhaps Fulton not. McKay. But yeah.
Really like Dr. Quinn. I kept expecting Jane Seymour, though. Because I saw the Dr. Quinn, I thought, oh, not her again. Yeah. And that French and Saunders line when Jen Saunders says, I just ask myself, you know, what would Jane Seymour do in this difficult situation?
Yes, I don't think she would have kept it Silurian. No way.
What would she have done? Had a bit more plastic surgery and just had a drink.
Fulton McKay is just always wonderful because he has that wonderful look about him where he looks all sweet and affable, but he can actually play nasty really, really well.
You know why he got the role, don't you?
Why?
Well, you know, he was after Ron Moody and Burgess. Yes, he was up for the role of wearing the big cape.
Yeah, yes. I think we did know that. As the third Doctor.
He was up for the third Doctor. He was in the top five choices. So.
There's a lovely moment on the making of where Carolyn John talks about working with Fulton McKay and she says, oh God, you know, he was so naughty. He would say, Carolyn, if you stand on this side of me, I think that'd be best. And John, if you stand, he just wanted to be in the middle.
And he's in every single shot. And Pertwee really knew what was going on. And you can watch it on that level and just see, gee, the Doctor's looking very agitated in this scene, isn't he?
Well, that scene where he goes to the cottage and confronts Dr. Quinn is rather like the scene... It's rather like that scene where he confronts Channing. Where, you know, he's all affable, but there is just this simmering resentment between
You've
the
You've got my past, reason. I've got your scene.
It's possibly in real
life. The Doctor being aware that he's irritating people, and he really does. And the stupid comedy bit where McKay thinks he's gone, where Dr. Quinn thinks he's gone, and he just looks in through the window, kind of smirks, and then sort of wanders off. He's sort of fabulously irritating in this.
See, that's the thing. I think we're getting a much better idea of Pertwee's character here, because he is being deliberately irritating to Dr. Quinn and Dr. Lawrence.
Yeah.
But in the case of Miss Dawson, he tries to be very sympathetic with her, yes, to find out what she knows, but also because he recognises that she is actually a very strong character, and it takes a very strong person to try to maintain a secret trust, even though the right thing to do would be to break it. But she has Dr. Quinn's trust. And
I really like her character.
Yeah. And if we look at the novelization, it was Matt Hook's... Oh, it's amazing. It was Matt Hook's intention that she was actually in love with Dr. Quinn, but it was completely unrequited. And she is such a... On paper, you know, you would go, oh, that is a very weak character, a woman with unrequited love for a man. But actually, she is an incredibly strong character. I think she's wonderful.
The way that Hulk does this too, and it's something that he does in all of his novels, is he gives much more background to the characters. You get the impression sometimes with Terrence that he's just taking the script and sticking he said and she said into it, and then look, I've got a lovely novel.
He did have to write like 3,000 a year.
Yeah, no, that is true. But Hulk, there's a whole chapter that really corresponds to nothing at all that we see on screen, where she's unmarried, she's probably looked after a sick mother or something, I can't remember.
Yes,
and she's kind of past the point where she's going to get married. She likes Dr. Quinn. It's a sort of older kind of world. It's very clearly the 70s, and so conventions are a bit different. But she goes over to his place, I think, for Sunday lunch, you know, regularly, and they bond, and then they talk about his discovery of the Silurians and what his ambitions and things are. And it's really lovely, and it makes her... She doesn't get really the chance to show that. The script doesn't really bring any of that stuff out on screen. But it's lovely in the novelisation. And I'm going to go on and on about the novelisation. I think it's extremely good.
It was the first... Well, I first encountered this story as the Hulk novel, and I think it's one of the best of the range. It still stands up. Oh, and if you haven't read it, you can actually just watch the Matt Smith Silurian stories, because so much of it is used as backstory for
that. I think we should talk about that too at some point, because I think that the Matt Smith story, while it's not great, it actually does, and this is kind of great. I think this story is kind of great. I think the Matt Smith one isn't really that great.
It's just Chris Chibnall's plotting, though, isn't it?
Well, it does some things better than this story does, I think. And we'll talk about them, why a bit later, I think.
I mean, one of the wonderful things about this story is the way it came about, which was when Terrence Dix was talking to Malcolm Hook about the new premise for the show. You know, it's going to be Earthbound, it's going to be like Quatermass.
Yeah.
Malcolm Hook's response was, well, you realise the problem, Terrence. You've got two stories now. You've got Mad Scientist and Alien Invasion. And Terrence said, oh dear, you're quite right. So Malcolm turned around and said, yeah. What if the aliens were always here? And that is
which Terrence Dix now spins as saying that he claims he simply replied, dinosaur men want their planet back. And it's not, because Max said, this is the same thing. You're giving us, all we've got is invaders from space or scientists potting around in their lab with Bunsen burners and petri dishes. And, you said last time, how boring would that have been to have watched Pat be doing this season of The Doctor as doing that. But do you think it is dull because of that?
I will say one part of the story that I feel doesn't work very well is that whole business in the lab. But it is also
interrupted fabulously by Peter Miles's camp comedy breakdown as well.
Oh, I think that's absolutely wonderful.
Terrific.
Simply because he's such a restrained character all the way through. And really, his power has been eroded bit by bit by bit. Am I to take it you have now arrested my security officer?
He's
so funny.
Yes. He's actually my favourite intransigent base commander so far.
Because he's the most realistic in a way.
No, because he's the most camp and kind of ridiculous, I think.
Well, you see, I think he's quite realistic for the same reason that I thought Hobson was realistic. A scientific base commander does not need to be this dashing, heroic figure. Like, Peter Barkworth is actually quite dashing. Like, he's a dashing older man. And Roland Lee Hunt has this great shock of white hair. He's very visually imposing. Peter Miles is this sort of very skinny, tall, comb-over kind of...
He does look like a civil servant.
Exactly. And he is a civil servant because he's got a government job. And, he's very much the chap who, the trains need to run on time because the trains need to run on time. Because if the trains didn't run on time, then the trains wouldn't run on time.
It's the moral duty of the trains to run on time.
Yes, exactly.
Preempting that, aren't I?
Yes.
Don't get me started.
and for that reason, like, Peter Miles cites that breakdown as one of his favourite scenes he ever did in Doctor Who. And he says that part of what made it so good was it took ages to put the makeup on. And there was word coming up from the studio, like, where's Peter? Why is Peter taking so long? So he was actually ropeable when he came on the set. When he jumps over the table. Because it's not just the repression of the last six episodes getting to him. It's the repression of his entire life. Yeah. And that's where Mac Hulk is so successful. Because everyone in this story is a character, including the monsters. Each of them...
Nearly.
Everyone who has more than two lines.
I think, I think that that's the intention. And the reason why I think The Monsters would have been a very, very clever title for it is, of course, that they're meant to be people. And in the novelisation, they're Morka, Opdal and Kato. I get the other the mixed up, but I think
played by Bruce Morka Lee
is and... Morka is the young Silurian and Kato's the old Silurians.
Kato is
no, 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 Opdal.
Okay.
Opdal's the leader, Morka's the young one, and Kato's the scientist.
Ah, right.
And so they're clearly intended to be people, which is why it's such a bizarre decision to get Peter Halliday to do all of their voices. So he's doing slightly different funny voices for them. And that kind of undermines them being people. And again, they're undermined being people by being sort of rubber suits with really obvious seams and places for the zippers to go and things that are clearly designed to cover the zippers and stuff and flaps and things. And, it's the 70s and this is probably the best we can expect from the costume department.
Do you know what else was going on, though? It was Christian Rollins who'd done all the designs. Apparently they looked really good in rehearsal. But on location, the cast and crew were staying in a hotel in Godalming that they were sharing with a conference for Olivetti typewriters. And apparently the two parties had drinking games to outdrink each other every single night of the shoot. And the extras were, the Silurians were the worst of the lot. So they just all terribly hung over and didn't get zipped up the next day. It actually colours Pertwee's performance quite tellingly when you see him stomping around in the mud.
But where the new series gets this right, and it is partly sort of technically, and people whinge whenever the new series reinvents the look of a monster, but here they get it right. And I know that the Silurians in The Hungry Earth and Madame Vastra and things like that, people complain, oh, they look like monsters from Voyager, and they do look exactly like the aliens from Distant Origin.
Which was a rip-off of the Silurians.
But you can, it's like what Pertwee says about the Draconians. You can see the human mouth, you can see the eyes, the actors get to act, and they get to be different people. And Hungry Earth even has an old Silurian, a young Silurian, and a Silurian scientist. You know what I mean? They're exactly the same thing, but they're much, much more identifiable as people than monsters. And I think that if you're going to have a story which is, it's about colonialism and it's about immigration, and I think it's undermined by having them be rubbery lizard head people instead of people.
See, I disagree, because when I watch this story, I can very easily distinguish which Silurian is which.
Yeah, no, because but one is sort of Peter Halliday doing a high voice, one's Peter Halliday doing a middle voice, and one's Peter Halliday doing a sort of another voice. You can tell them apart. But
yeah, not because of the voices, because of the physicality of the actors. The three actors do put in very different physical performances, and it actually makes them look different to each other on screen. Certainly the voices help, and to be honest, before I knew it was Peter Halliday doing all three voices, I didn't know it was one person.
And I guess the idea of calling them the monsters is, you know, the big discovery is the rubber-headed guys are actually just people, you know. Mm. And so I guess there is some ambiguity there. So the whole idea of colonialism is hugely present. And one thing that I want to recommend is that people should watch the documentary. If you have the DVD, there's an hour-long documentary on it. And I think it's one of the best things that they've ever done. It barely mentions Doctor Who at all, but it does talk about kind of racial politics and stuff like that at the time, and, you know, Enoch Powell and all of that sort of thing. It's really, really terrific.
The Rivers of Blood speech from 68.
And so it talks about, you know, in a sense, the Silurians are sort of colonial overlords who used to oppress the human ancestors, and now it's the other way around. You know what I mean? Or you could say that the Silurians are an indigenous people whose land we've taken, and now, or, you know, the Silurians are immigrants and we have to learn to live with them, and so on. And, and you know, all of these things underlie the story, and I think make it more interesting. And it is one of these things. Malcolm Hulk is famous for two things, I think, in the 70s. One is he writes the annual story about giant lizards. he writes one story a year for Pertwee, and each story features giant lizards of some kind. So he's their go-to giant lizard guy, but he's someone who writes about progressive politics, and all of his stories have a political message under them. And I think this one is the one that's most interesting, in that it has so many different kind of things underlying it and informing it.
So many. One thing I didn't get to say earlier, we should be really grateful that Peter Halliday lent us his prodigious talents. Do you know who was actually lined up to do the voices?
No.
Sheila Grant. Yes, she of the voice of the Quarks.
Oh, God.
That's what they were going for. So it was actually Barry Letts who stepped and said, what the hell, let's get Peter on the phone.
Because Peter did lots of voices.
This is all right.
Note perfect.
So Peter Halliday did... He's Packer, obviously from The Invasion, isn't he?
Yeah, but Captain Pugwash.
Really?
He is, yes.
But he did lots of voices before. He used the Crotons.
Yeah,
and,
we can forgive him.
Yeah, he is pretty good.
Yeah.
And he'll be doing a voice again next story.
He will.
Now, we do have a lot of firsts in this story.
We do.
It is, of course, the first appearance of Bessie.
Who, Kate Orman's theory, I think it was Kate Orman's theory, is that the reason that Liz reacts the way that she does to that news, because the doctor says, oh, she's called Bessie, and Liz just goes, I see, is that she realises that the doctor's named the car after her.
Yeah, Bess, Elizabeth, yeah.
Perfectly done. Well, it is built on a Ford Popular chassis, isn't it?
And,
no offence, Dr. Shaw. Why do... Oh, there's another thing. Why is she not called Dr. Shaw? She's a bloody scientist with how many degrees by the age of 30?
They only do that in parallel, fascist parallel universes.
I think she's a surgeon, and other people have said this as well. She did a biomed engineer degree, didn't she?
But no, they're really vague about it. She says kind of physics and meteorites and half a dozen other things, and she claims to be a doctor, a medical doctor later.
But the nice thing is, though, if she'd done surgery, that's the whole thing, you know, because surgeons are called Mr. It comes about because of the old naval tradition, but she's so I'd like to think that she's actually a surgeon, and that's why she gets to be called Miss. I'm hoping it's not just another bit of rampant sexism in the production.
We'll get to it in Inferno.
Yeah.
I do love that the first time we see Bessie driving, she's driving down a busy street. Every other car is like grey or dull green. The buildings are like beige brick, and you've got this gigantic yellow car right in the middle. Which you can only see on the new version.
I think we have to call it a sprightly yellow roadster.
A sprightly yellow roadster, despite the fact it's actually a Tourer.
Really?
A roadster only has two seats.
Yeah. Goodness.
A Tourer has four. So there you
Fancy
go.
Fancy you knowing that.
I know, it's cars.
Steve McQueen had just driven something that looked exactly like a 1905 Wintham Flyer in the Reavers that came out the year before. And, of course, there's Gabriel from the Secret Service, Gerry Anderson's. Really weird, wacky. Gosh, if you're looking for
it's closer like a to puppet vicar who solves
it is
crimes.
A puppet vicar who's sometimes a real person. It's actually my favourite Gerry Anderson show of all time. That is what I should have mentioned for War Games, because it has quite a weirdly off-centred reality thing of it. But yeah, he drives a cute little yellow car, Gabriel, which is also in every bloody episode of UFO you ever turned on.
And also for the final season of The Avengers, Patrick McNee traded in his green Bentley for a series of yellow Rolls Royces.
Not sure how we feel about that.
I have a sort of theory that John Pertwee is kind of cut price John Steve.
And Adam Adamant and the pop stars of the time. Yeah. He's dressed in the rags of the rich hippies.
Which is interesting, because as we've already said, like those things were on the way out. And so Doctor Who starts to do them now.
Mm. You notice that the car has replaced the TARDIS completely, and the TARDIS doesn't even get mentioned or seen in this story at all.
That's true. I think, and that's the first time that's happened.
Is that a bad thing? I kind of like that.
Yeah, it is. I think they're jettisoning. I think that, again, when we do Terror of the Autons, we'll see exactly what decisions for this season that they immediately reverse, and that's one of them, is backgrounding the TARDIS.
Well, Barry Letts did say that, you know, if he'd been setting up the premise, they would have had, for instance, three stories on Earth and one story off Earth. As proven in next season, spoiler alert, he does get the TARDIS working again, kind of. We also have the first appearances of Peter Miles, whom we've already discussed, and Jeffrey Palmer.
Isn't he great? He's so awesome.
But no Wendy Craig.
No Wendy Craig.
Wasn't he married to Wendy Craig for about 10,000 years?
What was that show called?
Butterflies.
Which was lovely. Carla Lane wrote that, who wrote The Live of Birds. And Wendy Craig was currently making Mother Makes 3, which would then be Mother Makes 4. Gee, the early 70s are a great time for TV. No, I've got them. They're gorgeous. She's a great comic actor. This is the nice thing about this season, that you're getting... Patty was doing it, but it was more for children. This is adult and gritty and kids and fantasy all at once. And you can jump scene to scene and have a completely different show, even within an episode.
Yeah, it doesn't go all out gritty, does it? I mean, you still do.
Well, we're going to see that in the next story.
Yeah, I think Ambassadors of Death is certainly the peak of that approach, isn't it? But this is
the experimental season. Let's see what we can do this time.
It does at least have sort of dinosaurs and lizards and stuff.
Yeah. And still in the public consciousness at this point was 2001, the film.
Yeah.
And this is, in a way, it's a reverse of 2001, because 2001 was about an alien species sort of trying to evolve man to the point where they can come out and visit them.
Whereas being here a lot longer than anybody realises.
Exactly. Whereas this is a species on Earth who've woken up and gone, oh, man's got a bit above his station, let's bring him back down again to the level we prefer. And what is really great about that is, you know, we've had alien menaces trying to pluck from man his mastery of space back with the Animus, and attack humanity in the future with the Ice Warriors trying to take on T-Man. But these stories are set now or in the near future. They are a recognisable world for the viewers. So this danger, instead of being some hypothetical thing, this danger is immediate. This danger could happen now. And by using a virus, measles was still a problem, smallpox and chickenpox in certain parts of the world was still a problem, so it was quite feasible that a virus could wipe out most of the population.
It is. Yeah, it was a big those fear. Scenes are so frightening, too. Yeah, they're really awful. When it's like...
When was the first anthrax terrorist scare? Because anthrax certainly existed.
Well, I was wondering when Survivors starts, but that's
not for a few more years.
Yeah, late 70s.
Mid to late 70s, yeah. But those scenes, so that, again, is... There's a bit of a sort of longer towards the end of the story where Pertwee's in a room testing drugs. I talked about it last time.
It feels like it goes on for ages, but it is actually only about half an episode.
But it is intercut with those scenes at Marylebone Station where people are just dying in the street.
Yeah,
like,
it's
really awful, and the police come and all of that. And in fact, the chase, chasing masters and all of that stuff is really, really good, but it is really as grim as the show's ever got.
Jeffrey Palmer has the wonderful distinction in Doctor Who of dying horribly every time he appears. You know, I think he's the biggest name actor that happens to.
He was in the Army Game, you know.
Oh, I didn't know
which
that.
Was with Billy, wasn't it? Yeah, so he was actually... Yeah. He has more right to be dying than anybody else in Doctor Who.
Because he dies of a virus in this.
Yep.
In The Mutants. He's
shot in Episode 1.
He's shot in Episode 1. And
which
famously,
would be very painful, I would think.
Famously, in the discontinuity guide, the authors say, Jeffrey Palmer's the best thing about it. He's dead before the end of Episode 1. And he has half a bulkhead fall on him in Voyage of the Damned.
Oh, of course, he's back in Voyage of the Damned. I completely forgot.
After he shot Russell Tovey, which makes him one of the most evil people in Doctor Who ever.
Wow, I must watch that again. I missed that this Christmas. It is kind of terrible, but I forgot that Jeffrey Palmer is in it. That's fantastic.
And, of course, Paul Darrow.
Yes,
very young Darrow.
Jimmy Darrow for this Jimmy episode, Darrow. Isn't he? Yes, we've had Jimmy Munro and Jimmy Bloody Everybody, Jimmy.
Yeah, that's the Jimmy. Jimmy
the, Jimmy's Magic Flute from H.R. Puff and stuff, I think, was a captain in the next story, isn't it?
It's really weird that we keep having changing unit captains. Was there a reason for that?
I'm glad you asked. There was.
Derek Sherwin.
Derek just smooth as Teflon. Derek Sherwin had this thing, I won't call it an idea, that it looks so much more capacious and UN and not just another episode of The Champions if you have a completely different underling team every single story. It'll seem vast. No, it won't. It'll seem choppy and discordant, and that's why we get Mr. Benton for the rest of the happy years. And then we get another captain coming in, not called Jimmy, next year.
Mm. Well, in fact, he is kind of right, because next year, when it does settle down to being, Captain
Dad's Yates, army in the future.
Well, now unit consists of four people, essentially.
It's kind of true, actually, isn't it?
At the same time, when you see senior army officers in anything else, they do have an adjutant. They have one person who is their assistant.
Mm.
Yeah. You know. So it is understandable. But, yeah, at the same time, unit does start to feel a bit smaller.
Captain Munro.
Captain Munro was great. But Captain Hawkins, Paul Darrow, he's not actually that bad. He plays it dead straight.
No, he doesn't. He's really camp. Again, and he hasn't quite, he hasn't quite got that snarling over-enunciation that Avon has. But he still waves his gun around the way that Avon does in this sort of massively... Yeah, sort of florid way.
Like he's saluting the troops at the colour, yes.
He's fabulous. He is really great. And he's got a very sort of piercing voice. He'll come back as Malin Tecker and he'll sort of out-camp Colin Baker later. Yeah, it's not a great moment.
He's revenge camping Colin Baker there. But I suppose here no one has wronged him yet. So he gives a lovely... I actually think it's quite an understated performance.
For him, I think it really is.
And the one sort of pity about that is you don't even know if he dies or not. Like, a Silurian zaps him for a second and he falls down.
Yeah,
and
he's never
seen him again. Yeah, he's probably dead.
Like Miss Dawson, who catches the plague and then we never hear... I'm sure she's better.
Yes.
I'm sure she's visiting her mother soon after, everything explodes.
Well, and she finds a nice gentleman to settle down with, which is, what she wanted. She wanted to find someone to take care of.
Maybe Octel survives.
Yes.
She settles down with him.
Actually, how about Miss Dawkins and Captain Hawkins?
Oh, that would be
nice. No, this story's a bit Old Testament-y. They all die horribly in one of the many plagues. Maybe she settles down with Ivan Orton. Did you notice that in Spearhead? Because they reshot the space sphincter in the space tank for the final episode, that was a remount Yeah, yeah. Apparently,
they remounted the Space Sphinx,
which is why
it's better.
Which is why it's really the only bit in the story I reckon that Pertwee looks relaxed because he knew it was a reshoot, and if they got it wrong, they'd do it again. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But Hugh Burden was back doing his other show on ITC based on the Edgar Wallace stories. So it's a bloke lying down in Channing's suit, but he's billed as Ivan Orton.
Orton. Brilliant.
So it's probably Toya Wilcox or Gary Glitter or someone, or Jimmy Savile, or someone famous that we own or don't want to know.
We don't want to know. And I just want to send out there a very big thank you to the restoration team, because the colour version of this story is magnificent.
Pretty damn good, isn't it? Yeah.
Like, I loved the black and white version as a child once I finally actually sat down and watched it. And then I never saw the colour VHS. So the first time I saw it in colour was when I bought the DVD. And it's just like, oh my god, the base meeting room is burnt orange.
It's horrible. There's a lot of orange in this story, actually. The young Silurian is pretty orange, too. And the Silurian base, I think, benefits from colour as well.
Yeah, it's a very sort of agate green.
Well, there's a lot of really weird psychedelic colours that are coming up, particularly next season.
Yeah.
Next season, I think it hits its high. But it is a feature of the Pertwee era. So we've had black and white, now we have this really, really kind of off-putting, psychedelic, kind of glam rock, top of the pops.
We're not just in colour, we're in bloody colour!
Yeah.
You know the opening titles were going to have Pertwee frocking about with his cape, and his cape would rise and drop to reveal the swirls.
Yes.
That was one version they filmed. Or one where he's doing a Christopher Lee Dracula thing with his arms outstretched and the cape wings.
And one where, famously, as Pertwee said himself, I had three noses, so we didn't go with that one.
Which is different to the usual movie. Did you feel that it was a bit... The score of this, you either love it or hate it, you know, because as we know, there's medieval instruments. It isn't synth. Some of it that sounds like synth is actually a medieval oboe that he played to Barry Letts down the phone. He said it sounded execrable. how do you feel about the sound of this?
Do you know, I really like it. I think it's really distinctive. It's not doing what Doctor Who themes do now. It is just sort of creating weird counterpoints to the action or something.
It's quite intrusive, isn't it? But then I think it balances the Silurian calling device nicely. Yeah.
And, you know, it's other things like when we're in the caves, you'll hear dripping water and the music will sound like dripping water. It'll sound like where we are. It'll sound a bit more technological, or it will sound a bit more natural.
Ophicleides, crumhorns and serpents. That's what you're hearing in those things.
Oh, yes, of course. I just think it's really atmospheric.
Because it's surprising because it's not electronic and it has the sound of breathing in it and something that doesn't belong to our time or our place.
Look, I mean, by sort of next year or the year after, we'll think of this as sort of classical music because the entire sort of Pertwee score thing goes completely mental.
And Dudley just, and Malcolm.
Yeah. I know, it's like someone playing a synthesizer with their face.
We get carried back for Death to the Daleks and Revenge of the Cybermen.
Which are essentially the
same. Yeah, exactly.
Death to the Daleks has got great music.
I love Death to the Daleks.
And the other saxophone. Watching this again, I thought, I didn't watch it. I listened to Carrie reading it audio that I just got right here.
It's terrific, isn't it? She does the best Pertwee.
I really enjoyed it this time around.
Her Fulton McKay is wonderful. I love her Scottish accent.
Yeah, I'm listening to it this time around in that version really worked for me. She really wonderful. Worked for me. But Carrie Blyton, I should say, I meant Carrie John. Carrie Blyton, other great course of fame for adding the clarinet to the Andy Pandy theme, writing the Bananas in Pyjamas theme, for which he got constantly paid. He didn't really have to work after that. And his aunt wrote the Noddy theme. So when you're thinking this sounds a little bit like play school, you're actually right.
The last thing I want to talk about is just the technology in the story, and specifically the cyclotron, which being used as a method of power was quite unusual. But much like the use of plate tectonics in the plot, it was cutting-edge science at the time. A lot of paleontologists still didn't believe that plate tectonics were a thing in 1970.
I know, it's so weird, isn't it? You just think we must have always known that, yeah, but it is really recent.
We didn't even know about black holes when this was filmed. Yeah. We're still 2 years off, yeah.
But the cyclotron very much interested me, because when I sort of really listen to what it does, I'm like, that's just the Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah.
That's CERN.
It's a particle accelerator, isn't it? Yeah. It's described.
And, you know, it's amazing that we go from that being a cutting-edge idea in 1970 to it being a mainstream idea. Certainly particle accelerators and particle colliders existed before the Large Hadron Collider, but that's really when it hit currency in about 2010, with people going, oh my god, yeah, that's amazing, look at that. 40 years.
That's it.
How is it going to be?
40 years ago, and Peter Miles had one.
How is it going to be a power source?
Well, but I mean, is the other thing the Van Allen belt as well? That's the other bit of science that we get from... Is that the thing?
Yeah, the school boys were writing into Matt Colt, apparently, to the production office, saying, got that long, along with the Silurian thing.
Yeah, apparently it is a thing, but it wouldn't have actually affected them the way they were talking about.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But there is a belt of the atmosphere, whose name escapes me at the moment, where if you strip that away, it would have the effect Liz was talking about.
Not the ozone layer.
We've lost that.
Quite possibly.
No, we haven't.
Almost. Look how burnt I am.
We're inside.
There is a kind of moral dilemma here, and the very last moment, I think, is pretty well done. So you've got the Doctor and Liz in Bessie. Bessie's stalled. The Brigadier thinks the Doctor and Liz have gone already, but they haven't. The Doctor does something very Troughtonian with his with the car. He puts something silly in the... in the cat thing.
Yeah, and tracks it going tracks down.
It's cute. Yeah, so there's a little bit of sort of silly fun, and Liz is wearing like an atrocious headscarf for no kind of reason. And then things start exploding, and it turns out that the Brigadier has killed all of the Silurians, that they've all been exploded.
Well, he's blown up the sleeping banks as well. He's blown up
That's how we meant to read it. It is sort of genocide.
And it's a really cold, cool, realistic moment for Pertwee.
And it's
kind of the birth and death of Doctor Who in these last two stories. This is the season 7, beginning and end, with the previous story in this one. And after this, we'll have a whole different show. Barry Letts did this. This was Barry's writing at the end of it.
At the end, yeah.
Yeah. The Doctor in Mac Hulk's script was apparently getting all excited about the new science-y stuff as it was scripted. Mm. But there was no death to the infidels as you get in this one. Well, it's appalling, isn't it?
Sandifer says it blows up the program. Do you know what I mean? He says, well, you know, why on earth would the Doctor ever consider continuing to work?
Yeah, why would you come back after the... It's his moral duty.
It's his moral duty. But I actually think that the script does go out of its way to try and justify it. So, you know, Morka is staying alive. Do you know what I mean? He's not hibernating.
And he's going to release everyone again.
He's about to release everyone. Everyone's set anyway to wake up in 50 years' time, and Morka says, make sure that you kill all the humans, you know, or deal with them and stuff. And with the death of Octel, you know, again, we have this thing where the Silurians are meant to be people, but they're just sort of genocidal lizards, really, with the exception of Octel. You know, all of them are quite willing to kill everyone. And so... You know, it is painted as a moral dilemma. It's certainly directed that way. And the very last shot of the story is, you know, explosions on the hillside. So we are left with that image. But I have to say the script tries at least to justify the Brigadier's position.
Mm. It's very up to date, isn't it?
What it also does is it really enhances the characters we've got. You know, it shows us that the Brigadier is ruthless in the pursuit of his duty. But it's also a great character moment for Liz, because in the revised version of the script, Liz was in on it. Liz knew what the Brigadier had planned, and so sort of bundled the Doctor out of the place, and then they broke down. And
they should have stayed. Yeah.
Well, Carol and John actually put her foot down and said, well, no, I think Liz would agree with the Doctor. She's a scientist, and she's not a murderer. And Pertwee said, how is the Doctor meant to live with this character of Liz? She's his friend. The Brigadier is just a colleague.
Yeah.
You know, he can sort of put that... He can't do that with his friends. So they're stuck up for each other. Similarly, right at the beginning of the story, when they go down into the caves, in the script, Liz was meant to go down into the caves in her miniskirt. And Carol and John was like, well, that's a bit stupid. Why can't, you know, it's not realistic. And Pertwee actually said to the director, that's completely ridiculous. The Doctor would not hang out with anyone so stupid as to go caving in a miniskirt, get her into a boiler suit.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, I bet it's the only time in his life he ever said that.
yeah, it all changes next year.
But, you know, we have heard stories that John and Karen may not have got on. There was apparently some tension between them on the set of the Five Doctors. But
oh, really?
More recently, with the now sadly departed Carrie John on DVD extras, it sounds like there was a great deal of fondness and respect between them. I think you were saying earlier, Richard, she idolised him and he was amazed because she'd worked with Olivier.
Mm.
Yeah.
They are nice together. Mm. I think they are nice.
They're
together.
A dream team. I'd have liked another year, thanks. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't possible because she was, as we later find out.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have for these two stories. We will be back to discuss The Ambassadors of Death and Inferno. But just before we go, gentlemen, do we know what yesterday was?
Saturday.
It was Saturday, the January. 3rd of January. Therefore, 45 years since the broadcast of episode 1 of Spearhead from Space.
Oh, how exciting.
So, in the UK, they're not here, yeah.
Yeah, in the UK, yeah.
45 years, goodness.
Just seems like yesterday.
So, celebrating 45 years of Pertwee, this is Flight Through Entirety signing off. Good night.
Good night.
Goodbye, thank you.
That was Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, They've Cancelled My Show, was recorded on January the 3rd, 2015. The next episode will be released on February 2nd. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. I'm not sure if we're worth 15 million pins, but that seems a very odd unit of currency anyway.
Do you remember the, French and Saunders sketch?
With the Silurians.
I am the Silurian, and I'm going on my tea break.